When it comes to paying people for the big oil spill,
the devil may be in the details.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bob Moon, in for Bill Radke. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, August 23rd. To sue or not to sue, that's a decision people along the Gulf Coast will have to confront. We'll have that coming up.
Also, in China, they're trying to get more people in electric cars and fewer people executed for white-collar crimes. Two reports coming up. And the Jackie jinx strikes again. To the companies he pitches, Jackie Chan seems to be the kiss of death. But first,
that $20 billion compensation fund for victims of the big Gulf oil spill opens for business today. 35 offices across the Gulf states will begin to accept claims from people and businesses that lost money due to the disaster. The man in charge of the payouts is promising fairness and more generous treatment than claimants might get by suing BP for damages. But already some victims and officials along the Gulf Coast are crying foul. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the latest.
Critics are worried some rules favor BP. Anyone who files a claim in the next 6 months could still sue the company. But after that, they give up that right. In a conference call with reporters yesterday, the head of the fund, Kenneth Feinberg, said it was his idea because it gets money into people's hands faster.
It is not in your interest to tie up you and the courts in years of uncertain, protracted litigation when there is an alternative.
You may remember Feinberg as the so-called pay czar, appointed to oversee executive compensation at bailed-out banks. He also ran the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund, where he placed similar restrictions on the money. Still, victims may be able to sue other companies involved in the spill after the six-month mark. They include the owner of the rig and several contractors. Hundreds of lawsuits have already been filed related to the spill. BP has paid out $375 million in compensation, separate from the fund that opens today. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
For more than 30 years, it was known as a bank that truly served an underserved community, giving loans to those who might not have qualified elsewhere. Now, Shore Bank is under new management. Federal regulators took control of the Chicago bank on Friday after financial troubles caused it to collapse. Dory Rand is president of the Woodstock Institute. This is a think tank in Chicago, and she's with us live from Chicago to talk about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Thanks for being with us. What was the significance of Shore Bank for its customers on the South Side, a very impoverished part of town, right?
It was, and with the help of Shore Bank, it had become a more stable middle-class community because Shore Bank was willing to make loans that the big banks wouldn't make in things like small business development and affordable multifamily rental housing buildings and in making prime mortgage loans.
Take us through what sort of differentiates, Dory, a community bank from a traditional bank.
Well, a community bank is based in the community. People are comfortable going there. There's more relationship-based banking. They know what the community needs are, and they direct their products and services to meet those needs at an affordable, sustainable level.
So it's just a different way of doing – I mean, I don't want to say that other banks don't like to do business that way, but it's a different way of doing business, right?
Right, and it's often at a smaller scale. So, for example, a large bank might not be willing to make small business loans for less than $100,000. And an entrepreneur on the South Side might have a plan to start a small business, and they only need about $25,000. Shore Bank was willing to make those kind of loans, and then that generated jobs and contributed to a thriving economy.
All right, so the bank gets taken over by this consortium of other banks. What's going to happen now? Is it still a community bank? And the future of community banking?
Well, David Vitale, who will be the chairman of the new Urban Partnership Bank, has said that they will have a similar mission to provide financial services to distressed neighborhoods like Shore Bank in Chicago and also in Detroit and Cleveland, and that they will apply to become a community development financial institution as Shore Bank was certified by Treasury and eligible to get funds to make those kinds of lending and investments in communities where the big banks really are not serving the needs.
So we'll see if the community bank continues. Dory Rand joining us from Chicago. Dory, thanks.
Thank you.
The Dow is down 2% since the year began, while the NASDAQ and broader S&P 500 have registered declines of almost 4%. And with the ongoing reversal of fortunes, is it any wonder there was news over the weekend that small investors are fleeing Wall Street? Some striking numbers reported in the New York Times from the Investment Company Institute, a trade group for the mutual fund industry. In the first 7 months of the year, investors withdrew a whopping $33 billion-plus from domestic stock market mutual funds. Joining us now is economist Julia Coronado with the global bank BNP Paribas. What about this, Julie? What do you think is causing this exodus out of stocks?
Well, I think that this is something we've been seeing since the crisis. Consumers were shocked with more than a 40% decline at the height of the crisis, and that really drove home for them that stocks really are a risky bet. And when we combine that with a pretty shaky economic recovery, I think consumers are much more focused these days on saving and protecting their principal than winning the lottery in the stock market.
I would imagine that big flash crash a few months back didn't help either, right?
Certainly not.
Okay, but if businesses want to expand, I've always really understood that the stock market is the place you go once you need to raise cash. What do they do now?
Well, I think the reduced demand is also being met with reduced supply. So businesses are shifting away from the stock market as a source of funding, and they're issuing more bonds instead. And since that's where consumer demand is going, it's a natural place to find funding. So it's kind of going hand in hand.
Do you think this is a permanent shift? I mean, Americans seem to love picking stocks. This can't be gone forever, or can it?
Well, I do think things have changed. The American consumer's mindset has changed in a more permanent way. At a minimum, I think people are going to allocate less of their portfolio to equity. And this also goes along with the fact that baby boomers are nearing retirement and they're more oriented towards protecting principal and towards safety than towards risk-taking. So it's a demographic shift in a way.
Sort of a generational kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Julie Coronado is an economist with BNP Paribas. Thanks for your insights.
It's my pleasure.
It's been a month now since President Obama signed the financial regulatory reform that created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That agency will be a part of the Federal Reserve. The administration has yet to nominate a director. One of the leading candidates for the job is Elizabeth Warren. But since she hasn't gotten it yet, some advocates see sexism at play. Marketplace's John Dimsdale has more from Washington.
Some of Warren's supporters, like Terry O'Neill, the president of the National Organization for Women, say the White House is reluctant to nominate her because of her gender.
I think that it's a combination of Elizabeth Warren's attitude and her anatomy that is encouraging the good old boys to try to block her.
In particular, O'Neill faults Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner for joining Wall Street's testosterone-based opposition to Warren. A Treasury spokesman says the charge is untrue and points to Geithner's praise for Warren's record as a consumer advocate. Geithner says it's up to the president to pick the nominee. As for Wall Street, historian John Steele Gordon says while it may be male-dominated, banks have many reasons other than gender to oppose Warren as a regulator.
Wall Street would much prefer a free market woman to a government-dominated male. It's their philosophy they care about, not their gender.
Warren supporters say they're gradually turning the White House in favor of her nomination to the Consumer Bureau. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, August 23rd. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us here in the United States. China is a country gripped by air pollution. Factories are all over the place. And now more than ever, cars are everywhere. Today, the Chinese government announced it'll create new standards to encourage the widespread use of electric cars. That news comes on top of plans to spend $15 billion to develop electric and hybrid vehicles. Marketplace's Shanghai Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
Some think the U.S. has fallen behind China in the development of green energy technologies, but China worries about keeping pace, too. Shanghai is so full of electric-powered motorbikes that it makes crossing the street a death-defying act. But automobile industry analyst Zheng Zhiling says in terms of electric cars, China thinks the U.S. and Japan are leading the way.
And that's why government tried to encourage Chinese company to take this opportunity to close the gap with the international players.
China hopes to put more than 1 million electric and hybrid vehicles on its roads within a few years. Part of this subsidy will pay for research and development among an alliance of 16 state-owned companies. Industry consultant Zhang Zhiyong says this is a good investment for a country that just surpassed the U.S. to become the largest automobile market in the world. And this $15 billion investment now makes China a world leader in government-funded R&D for electric vehicles, a message to the U.S. that a state-controlled economy has its advantages. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Well, staying in China now, that country today said it's considering dropping capital punishment for economic crimes. China executes more people than any other country in the world, but a draft law released today would remove 13 white-collar crimes from that list. Michael Bristow is the BBC's correspondent in China. He's with us live from Beijing. Hello, Michael.
Hello there.
All right. So what sorts of economic crimes are currently punishable by death? What are we talking about?
Well, there's a whole range of crimes. We've got issuing fake VAT invoices, falsely claiming export tax rebates, smuggling gold and silver out of the country, and other financial crimes. 13 in total will be struck down from the statute book, saying that they can be saying that they carry death sentences if indeed this proposal is put through the Chinese parliament.
And what caused the country, Michael, to reconsider its position? Why is it doing this?
Well, it's partly because of international pressure. The support for the death penalty here in China is very widespread. The government thinks it's a good way of cracking down on corruption. People think it's a good way of cracking down on corruption and other criminal offences as well. But many human rights groups say China simply executes too many people. And I think that's the reason why China's looking to cut the number of crimes down to 55 that carry the death penalty.
And very quickly, Michael, a time frame here?
We don't know yet. It's going to take some months, maybe years before this is put through. The Chinese government isn't yet saying how long it's going to take.
The BBC's Michael Bristow reporting from Beijing. Michael, thanks.
Maybe you've noticed more solar panels are going up on rooftops in neighborhoods across America. Not to short-circuit a good idea, but there are growing concerns about the safety of those panels. That's why Underwriters Laboratories, the group that certifies the safety of many products, has designed a new training program for electricians who install solar panels. From North Carolina Public Radio, Leonita Inge reports.
Historically, UL, or Underwriters Laboratories, has certified products. Now it's certifying people. Brad Smock is in charge of training these electricians in the technology of a solar panel, also known as a photovoltaic system, PV for short.
So when you walk out of a classroom here, you'll actually be able to go install a PV panel and a PV system, tie it into the grid, and start producing power at a residence or on a commercial site.
And as with any electrical system, there's always the risk of fire.
April 5th, 2009, the roof of a Target store exploded and caught fire.
That's Pete Jackson, chief electrical inspector for the city of Bakersfield, California, where the fire occurred.
Originated with the photovoltaic system that had been installed on the roof.
No one was seriously hurt, but Jackson says it could have been a lot worse.
What we realized and what the firefighters realized was they couldn't shut off the supply of electricity because the sun was out and electricity was produced, and it's major amounts.
Jackson and other electrical inspectors from around the country met at UL to help put the finishing touches on installation standards for the incoming class. And if there's one thing everybody agrees on, there has to be industry standards. Steve Callen heads the Solar Center at North Carolina State University.
There isn't a lot of agreement nationally on what that should look like. In fact, there are lots and lots of programs as the focus on energy has increased in the U.S., lots and lots of programs that have kind of sprung up out of thin air.
Callen says the new training program will add credibility to the solar panel industry and to the renewable energy movement as well. UL is expecting to train more than 1,000 technicians and electricians in its first year. I'm Leonida Inge for Marketplace.
Well, picture this scenario. You left your house this morning without any cash. Just when it looks like you're going to need more money to buy that cappuccino, you could try your cell phone. Bank of America and Visa are getting ready to try a pilot program in New York to let some customers pay for stuff with their phones. Marketplace's Janet Babin explains.
Here's how it works. Bank of America gives you a chip that attaches to your smartphone. A device in the store reads the chip, then deducts the purchase from a customer's bank account. So how is this better than a debit card? Patrice Perret is a partner at Nexit Ventures, a venture fund that focuses on mobile technology.
It's not clear what the benefit is to bump your phone against a fancy terminal as opposed to swiping your card, because it doesn't speed the transactions.
Paying with your phone is popular in the rest of the world, where fewer people have bank accounts. Analyst Charles Golvin at Forrester Research says banks and credit card companies see fees in the mobile future.
If cash payments are suddenly turned into credit or debit transactions, they now carry a percentage transaction fee for all of that volume.
Bank of America declined to comment on how much of a transaction fee it'll charge merchants during the pilot program. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Residents in Tuscumbia, Missouri, are using a new bridge that replaced a really old one. State officials said the decades-old structure was in bad need of replacing. The bridge was the first project funded by last year's stimulus program. Construction began only minutes after President Obama signed the bill. Now, some say the stimulus was an example of bloated government spending, but locals, well, they do like the bridge. Reporter David Weinberg takes us there.
It took me about 3 hours to drive from St. Louis west to Tuscumbia. It's a small town along the Osage River. When I arrived, there were hundreds of people gathered on the new bridge as the local high school marching band played the national anthem. Then came speeches from politicians, followed by a giant pair of scissors cutting a blue ribbon. The new bridge cost nearly $9 million to build, and it's the only way the town's 200 residents can cross the Osage without driving miles out of their way. Most people here make their living raising turkeys, hogs, and cattle. After the ribbon cutting, a parade of tractors led the way to a party in a nearby park. That's where I spoke with resident Joe Pryor.
So do you think that most people in town support the federal stimulus?
We do for here. I'm not going to get the politics of it. I don't know if it helped the economy, but there are certainly worthy projects.
I also spoke with Leisha Thompson, a school librarian who also happens to be the mayor of Tuscumbia.
Do you think that the bridge had an economic impact on the town?
Absolutely. The only real business that we have here in the town is the convenience store. So, I mean, all the construction workers were eating lunch there every day. They were purchasing their gas there. So, I mean, of course it had an economic impact on us.
In the 2008 presidential election, nearly 70% of residents in Tuscumbia and the surrounding county voted Republican. When work began on the bridge in 2009, many Republicans outside the region blasted the project as an example of wasteful spending.
Politics in theory is quite a bit different from politics in practice.
David Kimball is a professor of political science at the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
In theory, Republicans are against the stimulus, against much of President Obama's initiatives, but when they see government spending in their backyard, they like it.
There are over 13,000 stimulus-funded transportation projects currently under construction around the country. This is David Weinberg for Marketplace.
To see pictures of the bridge's construction and the blue ribbon ceremony, check out our website, marketplace.org.
And finally, in China, locals say movie star Jackie Chan will endorse just about anything. But the Los Angeles Times reports his track record leaves a lot to be desired.
Yeah, listen to this. He plugged a Chinese mechanic school that was later embroiled in a diploma scandal. An air conditioner he talked up had reports of a unit blowing up.
And the latest in the so-called Jackie jinx, a shampoo he pitched to stop hair loss, reportedly had cancer-causing ingredients. One Chinese newspaper said Chan is, quote, a man who can destroy anything.
Hey, Jackie, if you like our Marketplace podcast, for goodness sakes, keep it to yourself. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bob Moon. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.